Hello, today we're speaking with Matt Ward, partner at Forward VC and host of the Startup Tank Climate Investor Pitch Show. Welcome to the podcast, Matt.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me.
Brilliant. To start with, could you tell us a little bit about Forward VC?
I will. I wish I had that awesome accent to make it sound better. So, an early stage climate syndicate, i.e. a group of investors, LPs, family offices, rich doctors around the world who want their money to do more than just be in a bank account or focused on stocks. So we invest in the most promising climate companies, pre-seed and seed in Europe, North America, and Israel, with a focus on the sci-fi-esque startups that are changing the world in big ways and founders that something about them, you would bet on them regardless of what they're doing. This is the kind of person that you say, this is an absolute winner doing massive things and they're going to succeed, because venture is a game of exponential outliers. And we try to not only find those exponential outliers, but also be a little of the steroids, so to speak, that make them a success. So since starting Forward, a big part of my mission was to do something that truly mattered. I'd done so much in the past on e-commerce, D2C, B2B, things that just didn't feel that impactful. So I worked on connecting over the course of the last year. 780 is actually the number. I just published the new database today. Climate funds, incubators, accelerators, corporate VCs, trying to become super well connected in the space. And that's kind of how we use our syndicate. We invest in companies, but we say we're not going to be the biggest check at the table, but we're going to be the biggest hustler. We're going to be the one who introduces you to 20, 30, 40 investors, a bunch of clients, et cetera, so that we help you succeed. And that's kind of us.
Yeah, and I'd love to dig in more than into the founding story. So, I believe you're an entrepreneur, you were working on these other companies, projects, and so on. And so when you were trying to think through ways of impact, why did venture seem so appealing relative to potentially other options that were available to you?
So I actually wrote a blog post about it one time, and it was why I wanted to make an F ton of money so I could be a good person. And the concept was, and what I always had in my head, try to have a bunch of money so that I can focus on using that money, that resources, and my time on things that truly mattered. If I want to make an impact, for instance, in Africa, I could go and build houses, and then I'm one hammer. Or I could go and sell the hammers, helping people build houses, and then it's more hammers. Or I could create a company that's building houses in Africa, and then I've got a certain multiplier. Or I could have the company that's helping other companies create house building or architect firms, or I could be the one who's lending the money and helping. And you just get that exponential return the farther up that stack that you get. And that's why I was always interested in venture. So rewind a few years. I ran a podcast, The Syndicate, which was my way of hacking myself into the scene of venture and startups. I interviewed 150 VCs and investors that were focused on early stage, with the goal of starting a syndicate and ultimately a fund. Things were going pretty well. That had kind of been on my radar for a while. I ran another podcast, The Disruptors, which was a long form TED, all things exponential technology, which was meant to be the deal flow. And then my plan was to start getting into this and doing what I'm doing now. But just several years ago, things fell through on a earnout basis. Trump put his tariffs in place between the US and China. The guy that bought my business ran a trade company between the US and China. My business was an e-commerce business between the US and China.
Sure.
So then I got back to working with startups on strategy and growth.
And then as you were kind of thinking through I love this analogy of ways of having leverage, right? From the individual person hitting the hammer or building the hammer all the way through to like these high leverage ideas around deploying the hammers and basically being picks and shovels, if you will, to kind of slightly change the metaphor. When you're kind of thinking through that, how did you think through the emergence of an investment thesis? You talked about outlier individuals working on exponential technology, but I think a lot of VCs will say something similar. And so how did you think through the different options around developing a specific thesis that suited or had the impact on the world that you wanted to have?
Absolutely. So I'd spoken with a lot of investors at the time and throughout that time, and spoken with a lot of people in the climate and impact space as well as scientists, politicians, startup founders, probably interviewed about 1,000 founders from previous podcasts. So I got a bit of a framework there. But the framework I like when it comes to venture, evaluating something as a venture return or not, I like the three T's. So team, TAM, timing. So TAM, is this a massive, massive market? So think multi-billions and either growing very quickly or incredibly outdated and ripe for disruption. That's check one. Check two, the timing. Why is this something that's possible now but wasn't possible 1, 2, 3 years ago? Because if it was possible 3 years ago, why aren't there other people doing it? T number three, the most important, team. So as I said, in venture, venture is a game of winners and everybody else. And that's just how it works out because there is so much artificial fuel that gets pumped into it. You have the massive outcomes, the 100, the 1,000, the 10,000 X's, and then you have a lot of subpar performances, unfortunately. So you've got to have those outlier returns. The other two kind of categories or ways I think about things are, what's the defensibility? Is there IP, network effects, business moats, etc.? What allows you to build this and then have this be something successful that not everybody knocks off within the next couple of years? And going along the lines of that, there's got to be a bit of crazy. If it's a good idea, quote unquote, and everyone thinks it's a good idea, it means it's a terrible idea, because if there's going to be either a ton of competition or there already is, there'll be lots of funding and you'll never be able to make any money. So just on a venture side of things, that's how I think about things. Now, when it comes to impact side of things, a lot of VCs have different frameworks on how they think about things. So some say, okay, carbon emission reduction. Some say carbon capture. Some say amounts of waste reduced, etc. In my opinion, having a metric like that is actually the wrong approach, because it very much limits you on what you can focus on, A, and B, and more importantly, when was the last time you started a startup, came up with the numbers, and everything went according to plan?
Sure.
The LCAs, all the numbers are made up and going to be wrong. And then you're going to pivot in 2 years and things are going to be different. And you're also cutting out a huge portion of companies where, oh, they're not mitigating a gigaton. They're mitigating half a gigaton. I guess they're not worth investing in. And that just seems absurd to me. So the framework I have is what I like to call climate economics. I actually just wrote a post about this. If you guys want to check it out, forward.vc. So number forward.vc. Investing in companies that move the world forward. That's our little catchphrase. But climate economics, how I think about it is, there's unit economics. So for every bagel that I sell, or sandwich, or box, or service, or new client, or new, etc., how much are you making margins wise? If it's net positive, then you're making money. Well, I have climate economics, a similar concept. For every product you sell, for every new service, new client, etc., are you having proportionally positive improvements or benefits on the world and the climate? If you are, you're a climate company. That checks the box. That's my back of the envelope math, because it means as you grow and scale, you're making the world a better place. If it's not something where it's proportional and it kind of tailors off, then there's questionableness to it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I actually have a friend who's a climate founder, and he basically has a similar framework around what you call climate economics, but he's a bit harsher. He's like, there's real climate companies and there's fake climate companies.
Oh, no, I totally agree.
Right. And it's like, real climate companies, is their business model impacts climate in a positive way, right? Or has it, not necessarily just climate, but to your point, like this kind of larger framework of sustainability. You know, one of the struggles is like, if you're a company that's figuring out how to conserve water at scale through better monitoring of water pipelines, right? Something along those lines. That doesn't really have like a direct carbon impact, but I think there'd be very few people who wouldn't say that that's a massive net good for the world, for the environment and so on. And so I think it all, again, depends. Does the business model actually tie to that upside impact?
Exactly. Because if it doesn't tie to the upside impact, either while it scales, it's no longer going to create the same type of impact, or while it scales, the most beautiful model for any government or land in the world is the kind of happy, but there's a term for it, beneficial dictator. What's the benevolent dictator? The problem is you don't know what the benevolent dictator's son or daughter is going to be. And that's the problem when you have companies that don't have this in their core DNA and business model, is once you transition from doing good, well, maybe you bring in the next CEO who is doing good. But if we're public and we've got these different incentives and suddenly we need to change things a little bit, eventually Google erases the don't be evil thing from their corporate motto, so to speak, and then it's all downhill from there.
Right. And you can get it, obviously, in Google is quite big. And as you were talking, I was thinking about the Google example before you mentioned it. And yeah, and I think there is definitely an inflection point that happens later in a company's history. And I actually think about in the carbon credit space in particular, there's a lot of, I think, understandable the choices that certain companies will make where they want to both be the measurement of the carbon as well as the marketplace of the carbon, which when you're like a pre-Series C company makes a ton of sense, right? These are small emerging markets. Measuring carbon is very, very difficult, especially for some specific methodology, right? Like carbon in trees or carbon in soil, these kind of nature-based solutions type carbon measurement. These are emergent industries. And so getting a business model to sit just from measurement is quite difficult. So a lot of them become marketplaces as well. And that flies, I think, at a certain size. But equally, when you get large enough, it's like you don't want the company doing the measurements and the ratings be the company that sets the price. And I think we're going to also, as companies small, they get away in a, like a negative way. Like, again, people are just trying to figure out how to build markets in the first place. But as some of these industries grow larger, there will have to be, I think, segmentation in order to actually, for that type of the legitimacy of these markets to get to that next level. And so you do have these kind of balances. Like, it's easier to be ethical when you're smaller. But as you get larger, there's more scrutiny and you have to be able to respond to that.
Ethical or under the radar? You mean Amazon shouldn't be allowed to own the marketplace and the products they sell and let other people sell?
Call me crazy, but probably not, right? At some point, yeah.
I totally agree. We're not huge on carbon credit and carbon marketplace business models, just because it feels like more of a vitamin it feels like you're relying on better nature to make things happen. And at the same time, we all know how to lose weight and not be obese. And yet the majority of the world has a problem with that. So sometimes I think you need to forcibly make change. For us though, or for how I would think about it, if you're building a carbon monitoring solution, instead of building the platform, just be the referral engine for the other marketplaces. So then you're getting paid as a service provider and you're getting paid for the commissions or the referrals to a different marketplace. Then you don't have to build both business models. You don't have the conflict of interest and you don't need to have two different teams.
Yeah, and that makes a ton of sense to me. I'd love to go through this Team TAM timing in a bit more depth in each of those. Because I actually think in the climate space, there's some really interesting elements that are kind of difficult, both on the founder side as well as the investor side. And I want to start with TAM. So every time I talk to climate founders, particularly those who are fundraising, there's always this, I have a TAM problem. This comes up quite a lot because you have these two ideas in mind. First, if we truly take a full societal, you know, all guns blazing approach to mitigating the worst effects of climate change, TAM should not be a problem as long as you're taking a nice slice of the world economy, right? Because the world economy will be a climate-focused approach at some point. On the other hand, a lot of these things are completely emergent, right? Whether you're talking about, you know, certain types of advanced materials, whether you're talking about even solar and wind, which are probably as mainstream as any of these technologies, but are still combined in the United States, less than 12% of total electricity generation, there's kind of the sense of like, okay, these things can and should be massive, but maybe today they're so emergent or so small, you really have to kind of squint to try to identify like what an actual TAM might look like. How do you think about balancing the types of things that would have to be true for the TAM to be large enough to be venture backable versus what it actually might be right today?
It's the TAM and it's also the timing. So yep. The only thing that's worse than being wrong is being right, but with the wrong timing. And that's one of the big problems with VC. You're either, if you're too early, you fail. If you're too late, you fail. You've got to get the timing right. That's a great, great question. I think looking at like the CAGR, so the annualized compounded growth, how that's scaling can be one way to see if things are starting to take off. You can also, part of it's going to just have to be gut instinct, to be honest. So people may have thought that augmented reality or get whatever the technology was ready at X stage, and then 5 years later, it's still at the same place. Ray Kurzweil has been telling us for at least 20 years that AI will be here in 20 years. I think for how I think about it, I try to look at where I see the intersections with other technologies coming into play, where you see the incentives. So a lot of times with climate tech in particular, incentives play a big role. So are there carbon taxes coming, or are there carbon monitoring requirements coming, or are EU grants and other things pushing these things forward? And if they are, does it feel like there's enough forward momentum to make that stick? At the same time, they've got to have a large enough market now to attack. But in venture, the question shouldn't be what happens if it goes wrong or is this the right time, wrong timing? But it should be, what happens if it goes right? That's kind of the caveat. So having those different filters in place helps you weed out winners and losers. But then, like I said, with Forward VC, I've spent the last year trying to connect with all the big players in the space, the corporates, the VCs, the investors, the incubators, everyone, so that even if it isn't necessarily perfect, we push our companies into positions where suddenly they have that perfect, irregardless, because everything comes down to execution and connections. But that one step can make a big difference. If you suddenly had a conversation earlier with Honda's CVC unit, and suddenly if we're able to introduce them to the battery company we just invested in, and Honda decides to go forward, that's like 100 steps forward for Axion, the battery company, despite it only being one small little deal, which can help with things like timing and help with things like acceleration, so they can get to scale.
Yeah, and actually that does raise, so one of the things, just because you mentioned it before, I want to get onto the team, but this is kind of a very interesting situation around LPs. So for the audience, limited partners, the folks who basically invest into the fund or the syndicate, and are typically, you know, not directly interacting with the entrepreneur. But a lot of LPs are, you know, might be experts in a given domain that might have an impact, an upside impact, similar to what you mentioned. You know, maybe you're in the energy space, and a large energy company or renewable energy company is an LP of a fund that might invest in you. It's been actually quite surprising to me, having gone through a couple of fundraisers of my own in the last year and closed and have great investors and so on, that there's a lot of talk of how LPs can help portfolio companies. But not just from my own experience, but like talking to a lot of founders who in the climate space, generally the LPs have not really come to fruition in the way that I think that both the investors hoped as well as the entrepreneurs hoped. How do you think about that balance of, you know, actually getting a better connection between LPs who, in theory, right, are in the domain, could be that first customer or seventh customer that has a big impact, or even just on the advice side, versus maybe the status quo isn't quite there in terms of the LP accelerating the growth of an individual startup?
I think it really depends. So a lot of our LPs are individual angels or operators, and generally they like to be hands-on value add where possible, because they've been in that boat, they're involved, and they want to see their investments grow. Then there's the larger scale LPs, where you're talking primarily corporates is what it sounds like the question's leaning towards.
Yeah.
I think then you have to have some type of urgency in the offer, so to speak. So I was at a climate meetup last night, and randomly on the way home, before hopping into the tram, I bumped into the head of innovation with Danone, Danone, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, one of the top food companies in the world. And I'm advising a company now called Climate Crop in Israel. They've discovered a protein that increases yields 20 to 90% in all crop. It's not native to the crop, and it increases carbon capture. It doubles the carbon capture. So the approach I've kind of suggested to them, and the approach I brought up last night as well, is, look, we've got technology for food companies to half their carbon footprint, and we're looking to crown winners in different sectors. That winner can be Danone or it can be Kellogg's. And we're trying to figure out who we should work with. Should we have a serious conversation kind of thing? And I think founders can do similar things as well, where if there are other players involved, and look, I can either go to Porsche or I can go to BMW. Where do you think this would be more valuable? Or we'd like to go to Porsche because my dad had a Porsche, or whatever the reason is that you need to have to get that conversation going, because the last thing that they want is to fall behind their competition.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And just a side note, as you mentioned Danone, so I was the English tutor of a Danone executive in Genoa, Italy in the summer of 2006. Very, very long time ago. That's my major impact with Danone. It's just kind of a random thing. One of those kind of weird jobs. And yeah, at that time, we would just talk about the strategy that they're working on, because he was just trying to learn English or improve his English to talk strategy. And so I was probably told things in very out of date at this point. But in 2006, I was like, oh, I know all about Danone's European expansion plans at that time.
They seem to have gone very well.
Yeah, they're doing great. And they're moving into the alternative dairy and so on in this very interesting way. Love to get then onto the team side of things. So I guess when I think about like a classic Silicon Valley type founding team, you know, you're talking two founders, one maybe more business orientated, one maybe more technical, often both are technical, but just one focuses more on the fundraising and the customer acquisition. They are typically coming from a mixture of other startups potentially, or even big tech, and they're very kind of software driven. When I think about the climate space, because we are have really any effect, right? We are trying to change atoms. You know, we are trying to do something with carbon levels. We're trying to do some different elements with the built environment, whatever it may be. You start to see, okay, how do we actually get maybe the people on the technical side who are maybe not coming directly from a software background, but often are coming from more academic backgrounds where the cutting edge science often is. When you're looking at like teams, how do you think about what a good mix of team members are? Are there particular attributes you're looking for? And how important, I guess, is domain knowledge in the climate space relative to, you know, more generalist founders who can just move fast and I guess break things, even though that phrase has obviously been broken by Facebook's shenanigans?
I think it depends. I like to see even more so, my feeling and what I've learned and seen in the space is winners win and everybody else comes in second. And that's just kind of been the experience. That's what I've learned from other investors as well. When we evaluate teams, we love to see great universities, incredible expertise, people that have experience in the space, serial founders, well-connected. But it also has to be that person where you talk to them, you get that holy shit feeling. Like there's something special about this person. Maybe you get the goosebumps. They're an incredible salesperson. They're incredibly charismatic. Those are, as much as we don't want those to be important things, those are incredibly important when it comes to being successful in this space, because you have to attract funding, you have to attract talent, you have to be able to sell to customers. You have to have something tangible about you that gets people to say yes. So we definitely look for those type of characteristics. We'll do reference checks as well on founders to see what other folks have to say about them as a person, as a leader, as an employee. One of the checks I like to ask as well is, would you leave your current job to go work for them, or would you invest in their company now? That can be incredibly valuable. And then the dynamic between the two partners, how well do they know each other? Where do they know each other from? Why did they come together? Do they have complementary skill sets? Have they had and do can they have hard discussions? Those are some of the things that I think about, as well as we work with a lot of accelerators. So as I said, we've reached out to a lot of climate funds and accelerators. We've actually got a full VC database on our website for anybody interested. It's just forward.vc/VC database with all of those funds, accelerators, et cetera, filterable by stage, sector, geography, check size. But with that, there are some that we really like and know. So we'll rely on other funds, other accelerators, et cetera, for help on the due diligence on the tech side, but also on the people side of things. So company, I can't really announce that one yet, but that we're investing in now, went through a prominent accelerator that we know really well and has a couple of lead investors in the round that we know really well. And every single person said about this founder that she's an absolute machine and just performance, an incredible leader, the kind of person you absolutely want to invest in. And that was 100% my experience when dealing with her. And that's why we're investing in the company. Alongside incredible tech that is circular and world-changing, it's the people that know this person believe completely in this person. And that conviction is pretty strong. And it's a pretty strong indicator of success.
It's really interesting because, again, I'd love to kind of bring in some of my kind of recent experience fundraising. You know, and we were very lucky. We were quite successful in both of our fundraisers this year. And previously, I had tried to raise things and never gotten anywhere. And so I've seen both sides of it. And I think what's really interesting about what was shocking to me is how quick a investor will move after that first call. Like of our nearly 3 million invested, I would say more than 70% were on the basis of a total of maybe 2.5 to 3 hours of calls across all investors, like all those investors that invested. Often it's a 30-minute call. There's, you know, I'm sure there's a ton, obviously, that goes on behind the scenes. But in terms of the founder's own time with the investor, it's been quite low. And it's just been very, very interesting to me about how these large seven-figure decisions get made. And, you know, I come from a farming background where these numbers are, you know, kind of extraordinary. And so when you kind of think about, and you kind of went through, especially if they're connecting to other investors and like that kind of shared due diligence, and it sounds like you're nearly getting a specific vibe off them in the first 10 or 15 minutes. I guess, how do you kind of think through after the fact, right? Because some people are just as...
Adam Newman.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was at the YC End of Batch event last week, and one of the talks was how to identify high functioning sociopaths. And it was part of it was like, oh, they interview very, very well. And so, yeah, I guess, how do you think through when, I guess, like warning signs, because you absolutely, as a venture, somebody who's looking for outsized returns are looking to say yes, right? Rather than say no in many cases. But yeah, I guess, how do you balance that aspect of, okay, I'm only going to be talking to this person for an hour before I put in six or seven figures into them?
I would say the high functioning sociopath isn't necessarily a bad thing. If you were to look at public market CEOs, I want to say 20% of them at the very least are categorized as, is it sociopath or narcissist? It's one or the other. But there is something about that personality trait that does lead to massive desires for success and massive abilities to recruit and build. Now, that's not to say this is good or bad. It's just that's kind of how the stats boil out. What we look for, or what I look for, is at the same time trying to have the doubt and the gotchas of trying to avoid getting tricked by something, doing the due diligence of making sure the tech's solid, making sure the people are solid with reference checks. But it's, I won't lie and say it's a challenge. And we try to build up relationships over time with founders, but that's not always possible. Sometimes we'll come in once there's already a larger VC in the round and we'll just be doing a smaller check. Sometimes we're incredibly convinced by the founder, and then we'll go out and actively scout our network for intros of, these are the investors we want to be involved and try to bring them into the round. That's a little bit more of how we operate.
And because I know you have the Startup Tank Climate Investor Pitch Show, which I've watched many a video of, and sounds quite inspired by Shark Tank. And what's interesting actually about Shark Tank, which I've watched for many years with my wife, and is that they generally are looking for reasons to say no, right? So it's like slightly different to like the typical kind of venture approach. But thinking through, what makes a good pitch from your perspective?
I would say even in venture, they're looking for reasons to say no. Because if you're looking for reasons to say yes, you'll find too many of those reasons. So I think that's an important caveat. But what makes a good pitch? Well, on the Startup Tank, founders get 5 minutes to pitch. But what I like to say is you really need to nail the who, what, where, why, and why now of the pitch. So who are you selling to? What are you doing? And what's the massive problem that you're tackling? Why is your solution better? Having something involved in there with the traction of what you've got to date, that kind of don't miss out. Why now? So why this hasn't been done, and why this is the perfect one, and why you are the perfect one to do this. And then, of course, in VC, it all comes down to how big. So make sure you share how big and where this can really get to.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And I think that something that a lot of first-time founders, and particularly founders who I think in climate tech tend to be from more diverse backgrounds than, you know, a kind of classic software and tech background, you got to pitch a lot. Like, it's like anything else. You're not going to be good for a while. Like, I feel like when I was doing pitches, you know, and sometimes you'd have 9 back-to-back calls with investors, and I definitely wasn't as good at my 8th and 9th as I were in my, you know, the first one you have to warm up, but like 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, you definitely were better. You just get tired, all those kind of elements. But getting into a specific rhythm, right, how you're actually nailing that. And I did find that as you get more experienced, it goes from being a formal pitch to something more conversational and relationship building. And I think that does change at the post-Series A stage, where it's much more about the numbers. But I think in the kind of seed to pre-seed stage, and even up to Series A, you can just, I think getting into a cadence and into a conversational element with the investor is something that I think a lot of startup founders who aren't used to it kind of make a mistake with. How do you think about that?
I would agree, but I think you need to be able to grab their attention. So the most important thing about the first meeting is getting the second meeting. And the most important thing about the second meeting is getting the third meeting, generally. And your email just has to get a meeting. So in terms of how you pitch or get people excited, you really have 30 to 60 seconds to really grab someone's attention at the beginning. And that's what you need to hammer home. And then after that, once you've got someone's interest peaked, then I think you can play it how you want to play it.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Subject lines and emails are very important. Put your traction there, or put something that is very, if you have traction, or put something that is eye-catching, because you may only get the subject line. especially if it's cold.
And to have that traction and eye-catchingness also at the last slide of the pitch deck, because you want people to remember you and take action and not just next.
Yeah, and actually on that, there's actually a lot of, I guess, conflicting advice on decks. Some folks are, you need to have this beautiful stylized deck. I think we're moving more and more into that place. I've heard what I would probably call like not the ideal waste of money, although people have argued to me that spending $5,000 on designers to make a perfect deck for pre-seed is a good idea. But you know, I feel you can figure out with some templates something that's kind of cheaper. But how do you think about the impact of deck? Because I will say that, and I know this, the stamp of approval from an incubator like YC, which helps, but YC is very much like spend 20 minutes in your deck. They're like, it shouldn't look pretty. It should just literally be sentence number on each slide, and then you're done, which I think is quite extreme and was advice that pretty much everybody that I've ever spoken to outside of YC has conflicted against. So yeah, how do you think about like the time, the effort, where's the highest leverage part of a deck that an individual startup founder should look at?
A Harvard education is worthless, but a Harvard degree is priceless. It's some type of filter. So YC has that filter built in of, oh, you got into YC, I got to take this seriously. But for other founders, ones that aren't going through super prestigious programs, if you see two pitch decks and one looks nice and professional and one doesn't, who do you think's getting the meeting and the funding? It kind of comes down to that. I don't think you should be spending $5,000 on a pitch deck. That's nuts. If you guys actually, we've got a pretty good pitch deck designer. If you go to forward.vc, we've got an offers page on there. And there's a guy on Fiverr I found who's pretty good. He's done a bunch of pitch decks. He's something like 20, 30, 40 bucks to make your pitch deck look nice. I would recommend doing something like that once you've put all the awesome information in there to get someone to kind of spruce it up a little bit. But don't waste $5,000 on a pitch deck.
Fully agree. And thinking about like where are you seeing like the biggest opportunities? Like what parts the kind of larger climate sustainability space are you most excited by? You said carbon credits are maybe kind of less interesting to you guys, but yeah, what's getting you most excited right now? Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's a lot of really interesting things. Circular economy companies that actually have a business model that works. So generally some type of product and then some secondary monetization behind it, like the one we were talking about. We're investing in a company now that's decarbonizing plastic, and decarbonizing large industry is where I see massive opportunity because it's boring, old, outdated, and it's a massive input on the overall economy size, massive input on the overall carbon and emissions problem perspective. And if you just have a product that's better than everything else, price and performance or environment wise, you can have, I mean, you're not talking about small contracts, you're talking about tens of millions of tons or whatever it ends up being. It's very serious impact. We're not so hot on the e-mobility or EV space outside of potentially batteries. So charging, I think, is pretty competitive. It's kind of going to be a race to the bottom as Uber was and other things in terms of ride sharing. Anything that's a massive land grab is generally something we don't like to play in. We're pretty big on, let's see, what are some of the other interesting areas? We're seeing a lot in terms of carbon capture, not a lot in terms of effective carbon capture or carbon capture in the field. But I think that will be an interesting space. Reducing packaging, find fascinating. Things that increase energy production. So we're looking at a company in the wind space now. I'm advising another company that's turning rooftop panels. They're adding cogeneration and rotating axes, Maxun, M-X-U-N, so that they can generate 3.5 times as much solar energy. I told you about Climate Crop. Things that are making large industries a decent percentage better have very large impacts, and things that aren't necessarily sexy. So construction, ag tech, biotech, we're seeing a lot of very cool stuff. That's a little bit tougher because we need to really have help on the due diligence side of things. Overall, I would say there's just a massive explosion. Europe, Israel, North America are our primary sector, our primary focuses. And those are kind of the primary strengths, what we see when it comes to the clean tech space.
Yeah, I love a lot of those myself. I've jokingly said on this podcast in the past that if you're interested in starting a climate tech company and you don't have much domain expertise in some of the areas you mentioned, start reading Advanced Materials articles on Google Scholar. and find ones that were published in the last 3 years, and then like start making some phone calls to those academics and saying if they want to start companies, because the disruption of plastic, concrete, steel, material side, I think is really fascinating. And then you get to the higher order industrial processes in general, and that's even, I think, more fascinating. And yeah, you know, these companies are using Excel. They're using, like, at best, right? Like, even just thinking about the software side of things, let alone the actual processes and materials themselves. And so, yeah, I think that because they're so difficult to decarbonize, there's been a little bit of a delay, right? We've had a large focus on energy, transportation, this kind of flourishing around carbon credits and voluntary markets, which I agree, I think is not going to be, I think, what a lot of people were betting on a year or two ago. And then people are, you know, basically going through that emissions pie chart and just saying, okay, what's next? And I do think a lot of the things you talked about are very exciting, although the time to $100 million revenue might be longer than I think what a traditional kind of VC vehicle might expect.
I think that's both true and false. It depends on how quickly you're able to get those large scale customers. So on some of those industrials, on some of those construction corporates, et cetera, that's kind of the relationships that we're building with Forward VC, where we can connect the dots. And suddenly you go from a pilot to 20, 30, 50 million in revenue overnight when you scale across these type of companies. So while there is often a long sales cycle, if you can shortcut that sales cycle, then there's massive upside for the companies on both sides, really.
Yeah, absolutely. In the course of like a multi-year startup, a 6 to 9 month sales cycle is actually not that long, especially if the upside is as large as what we're talking about. Before we finish off, I wanted to get your take on some of the big policy changes. So IRA, which I'm trying to get people to use IRA instead of the IRA, because it's going to be a real struggle as an Irish person saying the IRA for the next decade. So you heard it here, people, say IRA, please. But yeah, IRA obviously has a ton of incentives for a lot of different types of clean technologies. You know, hydrogen, there's a ton of, on the energy side, there's, you know, carbon sequestration and capture. And I think that historically, there have definitely been some startups who tried to use regulatory arbitrage and, you know, will go deep into bills to try to figure out how will there be this kind of leverage that they can apply to their own go-to-market, their own products, and so on. But there's also, obviously, nearly by definition, a huge amount of distortion when you have these bills. How do you think about the best way that startups can kind of interact with these large policy changes to build a better startup?
If your business doesn't work without the funding, then you're setting yourself up for trouble. I think they should look at it as icing on the top and a way to hack their way into fast growth, but you never know how long those incentives are going to be there. As a caveat, though, in terms of businesses not being businesses without incentives, we wouldn't really have farming or fossil fuels either then, because there's so much in terms of subsidies that go into both of those. And yet those subsidies, even the fossil fuels one, have been continued to today. So I would say take advantage of all of the subsidies that you can. It shouldn't be the core of your business, however. And I think there's probably a lot of services and possible service providers or even software providers that just unlocking that type of funding for these type of clean tech startups could be pretty game changing.
Yeah, the main street for IRA is, I've had two different individuals mention that to me as startup ideas literally in the last week. And I fully agree, you know, at a minimum, look at the expiration date of these incentives. And if it's honestly less than 10 years, I guess buyer beware kind of thing. But Matt, this has been absolutely brilliant. Before we finish up, is there anything I should have asked you about but did not?
So here's the plug part then, I guess. So if anyone's interested, if you're running an awesome climate company and you want to pitch on the Startup Tank, it's just thestartuptank.com. You can find us on all major podcasting platforms. You can apply to pitch. We run that twice a month in front of top VCs like Lower Carbon Capital, Future Energy Ventures, Zero Carbon Capital, Uber Morgan, etc. The companies that pitch, it's really getting network effects now. It's actually pretty cool. The companies that are pitching are getting a bunch of investors afterwards, literally reaching out to them. By applying there, you're applying for our syndicate to invest as well. Speaking of the syndicate, none of this is a solicitation, but if you happen to be accredited or like investing in startups, you can find out about more and about us and what we do at Forward. So the number forward.vc/syndicate. We invest in companies that move the world forward. We'd love to have you look at what we're doing. Now, of course, we're not inviting you to join, but if you were to join, we're doing some pretty awesome companies now. And then in terms of maybe one last call to action. So for founders out there, for investors out there, if you're looking to find your ideal investor, you're looking to find other co-investors, you're looking to get a better overview of the space. Like I said, we published our, now it's 780 plus climate funds, incubators, accelerators, CVCs. It's on our website as well, just forward.vc. You'll see it on there. You can use all of that, filter by stage, sector, geography, check size to find the exact right investor, co-investor, et cetera, for you. We've got Slack communities on there as well for founders and investors. And we'd just, love to connect with anyone who's listening in on this and wants to play a big role in the climate space. We're on Team Planet together, I say. So that's why I published the database. Information wants to be free. So let's do this thing together.
Absolutely. And we'll include those links in the show notes. Thank you, Matt. It's been amazing.
Awesome. Thanks so much as well, James. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the Google Play Store. I cannot express how appreciated it is, and we'll be back next week with another episode.